Blog Talk Radio.
Oh my goodness, I think you guessed it, what we have for you today.
Do I even need to say it? Do I even need to do any teases? It's a full Republican debate breakdown. And actually, that's not even accurate. It's a full both Republican debates breakdown. I have stuff from the undercard, more than you would expect. More than you would expect from the undercard. And just everything ever about the main debate. I'm going to give you a general breakdown and tell you who I think won and why that is. And then we'll get into the poll numbers as usual, and you'll get a sense of who the people think won. And this is, remember, these are all, the polls we have today are all non-scientific. The ones that are taken like the night of and the next morning, they're always non-scientific. I mean, they're worth something, so I wouldn't totally dismiss them. But they're not as accurate as the ones that are going to come later on. But as usual, it was a shit show. I mean, there was, I think literally there were candidates throwing their feces. So it was a literal shit show. We have Carly Fiorina in the undercard debate. God, I can't take it. So many of these, substance aside, and the substance is bad enough, so many of these Republican candidates, just the way they talk destroys me. Like Marco Rubio with his fake politician cadence and rhythm. I can't stand it. It's like he's trying to talk like a politician. Let me tell you something about President Obama. Stop. Fiorina has a gift, really, of talking in a 100% pure, smug, condescending way, being 100% wrong on the substance every time she opens her mouth. Ted Cruz, do I even need to bring it up? I mean, you can actually see, it's fucked up to say this, but given how everybody else is, you can see why Donald Trump is leading. I mean, people are like, okay, at least I feel like he's not pretending. He may be an asshole, he may be a buffoon, but, you know, the only thing that's fake about him is the ferret on his head. So, anyway, let's kick it off here, and like I said, I'll do that with a general debate breakdown, and then we'll get into some specifics. So who won last night's Republican debate on Fox Business? Well, I'm going to give you my take on that. And again, I want to let everybody know before we continue here. I try my best to put myself in the shoes of just your average run-of-the-mill Republican voter when I watch this. So if we had a conversation about substance, that's a totally different discussion to have. But I don't think your average Republican voter is too concerned about substance. I think, unfortunately, they look for other characteristics in a person to determine whether or not they want them to be president. So you have to keep that in mind. You have to keep the framework and the paradigm in mind here and what lens I'm viewing this through as I give you my take. And then we'll get into the polls and what they say as well. So perhaps unsurprisingly at this point, I have Donald Trump winning. I take no pleasure in saying that. I take no joy in saying that. But every debate to this point, I've said that I thought he won. Now, usually it's sometimes by little, sometimes by a lot. This one, I think it was by a decent amount, if I'm being honest with everybody. And what I noticed yesterday is he has this incredible ability to always flip the argument. Now, I don't think he does it as some sort of master debating tactic and he's some sort of next-level genius where he's figured out how to do these rhetorical sophist tricks. No, I just think that he's a dim bulb, and this is the only way he knows how to talk, so he's just able to spin everything in the most positive direction for him. So one example of that is yesterday, when he was attacking Cruz for where he was born, Cruz being born in Canada, he said something like, you know, hey, look, it's not me that's going to be against you on this. The Democrats are going to bring a lawsuit, and, you know, you won't be able to, perhaps you won't be able to run in the general election. And then the audience started booing. And you would think that Trump would get, like, all flustered and think, damn it, they're against me on this. But Donald Trump, in his typical confident, you know, bravado-filled way, flips the argument back on Cruz and the audience and says, see, they're booing. They don't want you to make it to the general election. And then you have the audience burst out in laughter. And that little exchange was a microcosm of the entire night. Whenever anybody pinned Trump or, you know, the audience was against him, he found a way, a very confident way, to just brush it off his shoulder and move on. And I think your average Republican voter at home, they see that and they're like, yes, finally somebody who doesn't back down. Now, the Republican Party is known for not backing down. But on that point, he really is next level. Again, I don't think he's doing it because he's some sort of genius. I think he's doing it because that's how he is. And it just so happens that this is the kind of mentality that if you project it, the Republican base and your average Republican voter even is going to say, yeah, I like that and I like it a lot. And it's a nice change from the typical smarmy, sleazy politicians who we see all the time. So he's number one by a decent amount. Then I have Rubio at number two. I have him at number two because he's, yet again, he's treading water. He's, as I keep saying, guys, he's the establishment fallback candidate. If you're looking for a guy this time around who's most like John McCain two election cycles ago and Mitt Romney in the last election cycle, that's your guy. Now, obviously those guys I just named didn't become president, but they won the nomination. Why? Because when people actually got in the voting booth, they gave up the dream of the more, you know, aggressive Republican candidate, which was probably Newt Gingrich the last time around when he had his run and he was leading in the polls for a while. And they said, let's get serious here, and they voted for Mitt Romney. So he might be the guy that's the last man standing if he keeps doing debate performances like this, which are just kind of treading water, saying some of the right things, and getting enough people to say, yeah, we'll consider him. That could be very positive for him in terms of how this goes when people actually get in the voting booth. Then I have Christie at number three, believe it or not. Christie's like a slightly smarter, saner version of Trump. Now, I think his policies are still disastrous, and he's got major hurdles to get over if he really wants to have a shot at this. But I always find, or at least in the past two or three debates, he's had solid debate performances, and it's been enough to keep him on the main stage, you know, when other people have fallen, like they've had their moment in the sun, and then they went away. Like Carly Fiorina, for example, who was demoted to the undercard debate. So don't take too much away from it, but again, I think he had a strong performance. Ben Carson I have at number four. He said roughly three words the entire time, but he didn't do any damage. He was up there tied with Trump for a little bit a few weeks ago or about a month ago, and then he fell off when the media started hammering him and actually covering the crazy shit he says, like stuff about the pyramids. Hey, that was actually biblical grain silos. Well, it's not, and you're a crazy person if you believe that, among the many other things he said. So he kind of fell off a little bit. Somehow, if Carson makes a wrong or silly statement, it affects him in the polls, whereas Donald Trump can say anything, and he goes up in the polls. It's a really weird dichotomy. And then I have I'm sorry, lost my spot here. Where are you? Okay, boom, there you go. I have Cruz after that. Cruz came into this with high expectations. Everybody said that he's number two to Donald Trump. The recent polls have shown that. He was even surpassing him in some places, or he was at one point past him in some places, like in Iowa. And everybody was expecting, you know, hey, maybe this will be the guy, the establishment fallback guy. I mean, it's possible, but he's really more of a talk radio far-right candidate than people are thinking right now. Like I said at the beginning, the establishment fallbacks are Jeb Bush, who's doing horrendous, Scott Walker, who dropped out in 8 seconds, and Marco Rubio. I wouldn't really include Ted Cruz in that because he's not really the establishment fallback. Like I said, he's a little too far right wing, a little too much red meat to the base in order for him to do well in a general election. So Trump handed him his ass in this debate, and I think Cruz did a horrible job. And then finally here I have Jeb at number six. Jeb did a performance that's classic Jeb, said nothing in a confident way, said some sane things like, hey, Donald, not all Muslims are terrorists, and we shouldn't kick out all Muslims from coming to the U.S. And that sanity may come back to bite him in the ass, along with his last name. And it just seems like it's sad to watch this, man. I mean, he's hanging in there in the polls on some level. Like, I think nationally he's ahead of course, you know, Fiorina, Kasich, and people like that. But he just never was able to surge. And he's just lagging, and it's sad to watch. And I don't think he's going to mount a charge because for whatever reason, Rubio has established himself in a stronger way as the real establishment fallback guy, not only in the eyes of the public and the polls, but also in the eyes of the donors, and that makes a big difference. And then finally, I have Kasich in last. Poor guy, man. He opens his mouth, and every time he says something about my record, you know, I balanced the budget when I was in the federal government, and then in my state, I did the same thing. But it's like, okay, we get it. He says it almost literally every time, and it's not his time. I mean, I feel like Kasich would have done well in the 1990s or the late 1980s in the Republican Party when they were slightly more sane. But now it's just, you know, noise coming from a generic politician, and people are like, more Trump anger, give it to me. So let's go to the actual polls here, and we'll see what people thought immediately after the debate. So Slate has Ben Carson in last at 1%, Kasich with 2%, Christie with 2%, Jeb Bush with 2%, Rubio with 6%. They have Cruz at 10%, which I'm a little shocked by because, again, I think he got his ass handed to him. And then Trump with 70%. And that's unbelievable. 70%. We shoot on over to Drudge here. They have Bush at 1.5%, Carson at 1.6%, Kasich at 1.7%, 2%, Rubio at 8.5%, Cruz at 31.4%, and Trump at 53.1%. And this poll, by the way, had hundreds of thousands of people who voted in it. Now, again, these are unscientific, so, you know, don't take them to the bank, but they're worth something, I think, at least. And then finally, we go to Time and their poll. Carson had 2%, Christie had 3%, Kasich had 4%, Bush had 8%. Hanging in there in the Time poll. Rubio had 9%, Cruz had 12%, and Trump had 62%. The guy is just fucking owning them. He's owning them. So it really does look like it's Trump's race to lose. I've said this a few times before, but now I'm at the point where I don't even want to tolerate discussion on it. Like, if you take the position that it's not his race to lose, okay, then you just disagree with math. Because not only in all the snap polls is he winning, even when they do the scientific polls later on, he's winning. And he surged back. He was behind in Iowa and New Hampshire. He surged back. He's in the lead again. Nationally, he's leading by over 20 points or something like that. It's his race to lose, man. I don't know. I don't know why it is, but I still don't see Cruz as the viable contender to him because he's just the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, far right base go-to, and those guys usually flare out at some point in these things. But I think his biggest contender is Rubio, and that's not good news because if anybody can fuck this thing up and hand the election to Trump, it's fucking Waterboy Rubio. Because he's all talking points, he's an empty suit, he's a standard politician. Now, again, the standard politicians did well in the last two presidential election cycles on the Republican side. They got the nomination, John McCain and Mitt Romney. But it may just be another day in America, and it's just that people don't want that anymore, and they want somebody who just comes across as super anti-establishment and an outsider like Donald Trump, even though he's not necessarily those things. So if you're fearing the Donald Trump nomination, I'm here to tell you that's a legitimate fear. Okay. Next, We break out the video clips now, and believe me when I say, they don't go away. They're here for the rest of the show. Every segment is somebody saying some stupid shit. Or actually, is that true? I don't know if I give credit to anybody in the show that you're about to hear. Donald Trump, oh, I lied. This first story, I'm actually giving some credit. Wow. Donald Trump responded to some criticisms of his campaign last night. And in my opinion, he kind of nailed it. Let's watch.
First of all, Nikki this afternoon said I'm a friend of hers, actually a close friend. And wherever you're sitting, Nikki, I am a friend. We're friends. That's good. But she did say there was anger. And I could say, oh, I'm not angry. I'm very angry because our country is being run horribly. And I will gladly accept the mantle of anger. Our military is a disaster. Our health care is a horror show. Obamacare, we're going to repeal it and replace it. We have no borders. Our vets are being treated horribly. Illegal immigration is beyond belief. Our country is being run by incompetent people. And yes, I am angry. And I won't be angry when we fix it. But until we fix it, I'm very, very angry. And I say that to Nikki. So when Nikki said that, I wasn't offended. She said the truth. One of your colleagues interviewed me and said, well, she said you were angry. And I said to myself, huh, she's right. I'm not fighting that. I didn't find it offensive at all. I'm angry because our country is a mess.
Politically, that's brilliant. So for those of you who don't know, Nikki Haley gave the response to Obama's State of the Union, and she pretty clearly and kind of directly went after Donald Trump by saying, hey, let's not fall into the politics of anger here and point fingers and blame. Let's accept responsibility when we're wrong, and let's say that others are wrong when they are wrong, but let's not basically go the road of Donald Trump. This is what she was saying. And Trump always finds a way to flip the argument in a quick and clever way. Because what he did there is he basically doubled down and said, like, I'm not the crazy one. You're the crazy one. Like, am I angry? Yeah, why wouldn't I be? Of course I'm angry. You're not angry? Well, that's weird. You're the one that's off base here. I don't know why you wouldn't be angry. And you got to understand, man, that's hitting a nerve. That's tapping into genuine populist rage because when Nikki Haley says something like that, people are going to think, well, that's inside the Beltway, even though she's not in Washington. But that's like establishment 101 wisdom of fake happy-go-lucky or everything is good for the elites, but not for everybody else, and you just don't see what we're going through. That's what people will think. And then Trump comes along and says, yeah, you're wrong. The people are right. You should be angry. There are all these problems. I'm going to fix them. So am I angry? Yeah, I'm not going to take that as, if anything, that's more of a compliment than saying something negative about me. Of course I'm angry. What rational person wouldn't be angry? And again, that's politically brilliant. He sounds like an outsider. He sounds like he's anti-establishment. Now, that's not true. He's a billionaire. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He tried to get money from the billionaires to run for president. They said no to him. Only after they said no to giving him money, then he went out there and ripped everybody else for taking money. He's like, are these guys puppets of their donors? They're taking money. You just asked for it. But only when they said no does he start attacking them. So he sounds like an outsider. He sounds like he's anti-establishment. And people love that. And then on top of that, you mix in the confidence and the bravado and the arrogance. And people are like, oh, finally somebody who doesn't back down. And then there's also the added bonus of Trump saying everything at the same time. You didn't see it in this clip, but he always contradicts himself. And you would think that that would make a rational voter go, oh, that doesn't add up. You said the opposite things at the same time. That's not possible. But the Republican base, they don't care about logic. They don't care about rationality. They don't care about contradictions. They just want to project onto Trump whatever they want him to be. So if he says everything at the same time, it's a menu. You just pick whatever your pet issue is, and you go, see, he represents me on that. So, for example, he'll say stuff about the Muslims and the Mexicans, they're horrendous, they're terrible.
But then in the next sentence, he'll say, we need to do infrastructure spending in this country and make America great again and create jobs by spending our government money. And everybody's like, the fuck? So it's super liberal on points and super conservative and far right on points. And he does that on almost every issue. On foreign policy, he's like, we should stay out of Syria. Let Vladimir Putin do the work. And then another day, he's like, not only should we be involved there, we should bomb the families of ISIS people there. Says everything at the same time. So you, as a Republican-based voter, get to just remember the good stuff and say, that's my guy right there. Everybody was wrong about Trump from the beginning, including me. Okay, we all said he has no shot whatsoever. He'll never even get a day in the sun. A lot of people said that. I wasn't in that crowd. I was in the crowd of he's like Newt Gingrich, how Newt Gingrich was the last time around, where he had his moment in the sun. He led in the polls for a while, and then he fell off. Okay, but already Trump has surpassed Newt Gingrich's run here. He's been leading from day one, and he's been leading by a mile and a half. And he's very, very politically savvy. Whether or not he even realized it, I don't think he realized it. I think he's just being himself and being a dick, and it works out like that. But believe me, he's a serious contender, and yes, that should scare you. Okay. Now we go to Ted Cruz. This is the opposite of Trump with politically savvy. This is actually really bad. Ted Cruz is going to try and explain away his corruption at the debate last night, and he faceplants.
Is reporting that you failed to properly disclose $1 million in loans from Goldman Sachs and Citibank during your Senate race. Your campaign says it was inadvertent. $1 million is inadvertent.
Well, Maria, thank you for passing on that hit piece on the front page of the New York Times. You know, the nice thing about the mainstream media, they don't hide their views. The New York Times a few weeks back had a columnist who wrote a column saying anybody but Cruz. Had that actually another, that same columnist wrote a column comparing me to an evil demonic spirit from the movie It Follows that jumps apparently from body to body possessing people. So, you know, the New York Times and I don't exactly have the warmest of relationships. Now, in terms of their really stunning hit piece, what they mentioned is when I was running for Senate, unlike Hillary Clinton, I don't have masses of money in the bank, hundreds of millions of dollars. When I was running for Senate, just about every lobbyist, just about all of the establishment opposed me in the Senate race in Texas. And my opponent in that race was worth over $200 million. He put a $25 million check up from his own pocket to fund that campaign. And my wife Heidi and I, we ended up investing everything we own. We took a loan against our assets to invest it in that campaign to defend ourselves against those attacks. And the entire New York Times attack is that I disclosed that loan on one filing with the United States Senate that was a public filing, but it was not on a second filing with the FEC. Both of those filings were public, and yes, I made a paperwork error disclosing it on one piece of paper instead of the other, but if that's the best hit the New York Times has got, they better go back to the well.
That was a horrible answer. And that's one of those things where he's playing to the room and not to everybody watching on TV and everybody at home and normal people. So it's just like a knee-jerk reactionary brush it aside response, but you don't really explain why it's wrong. And if anything, you made it worse because you're admitting that you took $1 million from Goldman Sachs. So this is horrible in every way. So let me break this down for you. First of all, his response is, me, New York Times, me. Ted, that's not a response. That's not a response outside of the room you're in. Okay? Everybody at home's like, okay, yeah, New York Times. We get it. It's a paper. It exists. What are you saying? The New York Times said it. You know what I'm saying? No, I don't know what you're saying. What are you saying? New York Times. It's just New York Times. That's not an argument.
It's effectively, the point he's making is effectively, liberal media. If your go-to response every time there's any criticism of you is liberal media, you're an idiot. Because that means you have no real response, so you just deflect everything and say, well, it's just biased against me. Well, that means nobody can ever make a point against you about anything, even if it's factual, because you're just going to dismiss it as, well, it's just biased. Well, what if that's the truth? It's just biased against me. New York Times. And then when he explains what actually happened, Ted, you idiot, you don't get it. People who are, even in the room, the people who are sitting there, they don't want to hear about FEC and disclosure and transaction and election law and what I filed with the paperwork with the this and the that. All they're hearing is, I took the money. I took the money from Goldman Sachs. I took $500,000, it was actually $500,000 for himself and his campaign, and then his wife, who worked for Goldman Sachs, got another $500,000. Now, we don't know if that money went just to the family as a loan, or if they took that money and also poured it into the campaign. But either way, it's bad. So that's where they get the $1 million number from. And what Ted Cruz is doing here, he doesn't even realize it, is he's admitting that he took the money. As he's explaining, but yeah, but the paperwork and the way I filed it and this and that is liberal media, New York Times. It's not an argument, Ted, and you just admitted you took the money. So all of your, I'm anti-establishment, I'm Ted Cruz, me, I look out for the little guy, me. Apparently not, because you took, you know, you're taking $1 million from Goldman fucking Sachs, the embodiment of the establishment and the elite. Are you kidding me? So I don't think that went over well. Again, this is the problem with Ted Cruz. He's doing well in the polls right now. I don't think it'll last, man, because he is the Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck kind of candidate. Those guys, they're not as popular as you think they are, okay? I mean, it's only a matter of time until your house of cards falls when you're only playing to the furthest right element in American politics. You're preaching to the choir with answers like that. New York Times, liberal media, yeah, I took the money, but I just closed it over there, not over there. Whoops, my bad, but I got you. I took the money, but I got you. No, they got you. You just admitted you took the money, you jackass. You're corrupt. Okay, I got to take a break here. When we come back, Bernie Sanders gets mocked, and then the most interesting back and forth of the debate, guess who comes out on top? Guess who gets owned? All right, stay right there, guys. I'ma stay rapping for my real nigga. That's just some shit that I'm gonna do. Fuck all the commas. Let's fuck all the commas, nigga. Let's fuck all the commas. Do this shit wrong. Sleep 2 hours, yeah. Put 24s on a new outing. Yeah. White on white light, baby powder. Yeah. Drop the bitch.
Yeah. Dumb clubs like those. Yeah. Watch down the goodness. Yeah. Get no fucks. Yeah. We don't get no fucks. Yeah. Don't feel my cup. Yeah. Bitch, don't feel my cup. Yeah. You heard that song, man. I'm cool with the convict. The cooler like A cut. Fuck out of bum shit. But that's coming.
Guys, let's talk a little bit about Mr. Irrelevant himself, John Kasich. John Kasich, of all people, mocked Bernie Sanders and his chances of becoming president. Check it out.
John Kasich, Hillary Clinton is getting some serious competition from Senator Bernie Sanders. He's now at 41% in the latest CBS New York Times poll. Vice President Biden sang his praises, saying Bernie is speaking to a yearning that is deep and real, and he has credibility on it. So what does it say about our country that a candidate who is a self-avowed socialist and who doesn't think a 90% tax rate is too high could be the Democratic nominee?
Well, if that's the case, we're going to win every state. Bernie Sanders is the nominee. That's not even an issue. Look, and I know Bernie, and I can promise you he's not going to be president of the United States. So here's the situation, I think, Maria.
Who are you? I forget who's talking right now. Does John Kasich's wife even know that he's running? Does your family know, bro? This jackass was on Twitter earlier today touting an endorsement of some guy I've never heard of. Dude, you're polling at negative 47%. He's like, let me tell you a little something about Bernie Sanders' chances. Non-existent. We're going to win every state if Bernie Sanders. God, they're so arrogant. They have no clue what's about to hit them. And they, notice, no argument. There's no argument. Bernie Sanders. He's not going to win. It's Bernie. Bernie. Bernie Sanders. Yeah, and? Do you have a point somewhere in there? Bernie Sanders. Bernie. Go on, please. I'm waiting for anything logical to come out of your mouth. Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders. And then, you know, when you push him hard enough. I mean, come on, man. He's a socialist. He's old. He's Jewish. An atheist. All these, yeah, these are all bad things. This sounds very similar. Where have I heard arguments like this before? It wasn't that long ago that Hillary's campaign was saying the same thing about a guy named Barack Hussein Obama, a black Democrat
who's young and inexperienced. Barack Hussein Obama! We're going to vote for somebody named Hussein! We're going to vote for somebody named Hussein! Hussein is our enemy! His name is Hussein, but we're going to vote for somebody named Hussein! He's black! He's young! He's inexperienced! This guy can't win! Get him out of here! It's inevitable. Hillary Clinton's going to get the nomination. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. What happened? I forget how the rest of that went. Did something happen? Did I miss something? We're in President Hillary Clinton's second term right now, am I right? These guys are so arrogant. And you know what it is, man? This shows you how disconnected they are. Because there's a reason why Bernie Sanders is surging. He's saying things that people believe and they wanted somebody to say for a long time. And that's not just my opinion. Look at the polling data! Look at the polling data! On virtually every issue, Bernie Sanders has a majority of people with him. You name the issue, I'll tell you the numbers, man. You know, whether you're talking about raising the minimum wage or increasing unionization or not cutting, in fact, expanding Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid or taxing the rich more or stopping our, policing of the world, which is something that Bernie's spoken about time and time again. These are all things that are popular. But they're just dismissing him, and they're dismissing him at face value because they're so deep in that establishment bubble, man. People don't get this. In the establishment bubble, this is still not even an option that Bernie wins. It's still impossible. In the establishment bubble, they're still like, yeah, come on. Brush him aside. What are you kidding me? Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders. That's the way they look at it. They won't give you an argument. It's just Bernie Sanders. They just, come on, man. Let's be serious people here. We need serious people to run for president, like people who sell out to Wall Street and big money interests. And, oh, my God, people don't like that? What? The American people aren't being duped by that anymore? What? I'm so surprised. Hillary seems so likable. Jeb Bush, I mean, there's a charismatic guy. He was going to make it all the way. So just to further rub in how ridiculous John Kasich is. Is that his name? I forget. Are you John Kasich? What? Somebody had an awesome tweet a few debates ago. Like, Martin Kasich O'Malley John whatever, he got to get out of the debate, whoever it is. That's who you are, John O'Malley Kasich. Who are you? Who are you? He's at 2% nationally. Bernie's at 40% nationally. Bernie is even beating the front runner of the Republican Party, Donald Trump. Bernie's at 40%. Kasich's at 2%. And here's the most ironic part of it all. Kasich is running on, I'm the budget guy. I balance budgets. I'm good at math. Bernie's at 40%. He has no chance. I'm at 2%. I have a chance. No, you don't, slapstick. No, you don't. Bernie's just 8 points behind Hillary right now, when just a few months ago, he was nearly 40 points behind her. Guys, he's winning in Iowa and New Hampshire in some polls now. He's closing the gap incredibly fast. He's doing better, how's this for a fact? He's doing better at this point in his race than Obama was doing at this point in his race in 2008 against Hillary. Please, proceed, sir. Tell me more about how he has no chance. That fucking break song is so catchy, man. You're not going to be able to get that out of your head. And don't worry, nobody knows what he's saying. He doesn't even know what he's saying. I've never heard a Future song and gone, I got it. I got all the lyrics. Nobody's ever done that. All right. Now we get to the biggest fight of the night. This is Tyson Holyfield. This is Ali Frazier. Ted Cruz and Donald Trump had a fascinating back and forth last night at the Republican debate. Let's watch here, and then I'll explain to you who I think won.
Senator Cruz, you suggested Mr. Trump, quote, embodies New York values. Could you explain what you mean by that?
You know, I think most people know exactly what New York values are.
I am from New York.
Well, you're from New York, so yeah. You might not. But I promise you, the state of South Carolina, they do. And listen, there are many, many wonderful, wonderful working men and women in the state of New York. But everyone understands that the values in New York City are socially liberal, or pro-abortion, or pro-gay marriage, focus around money and the media. And I would note, indeed, the reason I said that is I was asked, my friend Donald has taken to at his events playing Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. And I was asked what I thought of that, and I said, well, if he wanted to play a song, maybe he could play New York, New York. Not a lot of conservatives come out of Manhattan. I'm just saying.
Are you sure about that?
Maria. So, conservatives actually do come out of Manhattan, including William F. Buckley and others, just so you understand. And just so, if I could, because he insulted a lot of people, I've had more calls on that statement that Ted made. New York is a great place. It's got great people. It's got loving people, wonderful people. When the World Trade Center came down, I saw something that no place on earth could have handled more beautifully, more humanely than New York. You had two 100... You had two 110-story buildings come crashing down. I saw them come down. Thousands of people killed, and the cleanup started the next day, and it was the most horrific cleanup probably in the history of doing this and in construction. I was down there, and I'd never seen anything like it. And the people in New York fought and fought and fought, and we saw more death and even the smell of death. Nobody understood it, and it was with us for months, the smell, the air. And we rebuilt downtown Manhattan, and everybody in the world watched, and everybody in the world loved New York and loved New Yorkers. And I have to tell you, that was a very insulting statement that Ted made.
Damn, that hurt. Now, I was watching my parent network, TYT. They do a live thing every time there's a one of these debates. And by the way, for those of you who don't have Twitter and you want to see me be an obnoxious douchebag during the debates, tune in there because they put up like their Twitter feed on the screen and you can see all of my immensely douchey points about the debate there. And there was a great point that Cenk made about this. Now, typically when politicians bring up 9/11, it's the sleaziest trick ever. And, in fact, Hillary Clinton did that at one of the recent debates where they were talking about Wall Street contributions, and Hillary was like, yeah, I took money from Wall Street because 9/11. 9/11. Everybody's like, what the – that has – those things are not related, you know – because they were attacked doesn't mean you should take money from other Wall Street financial institutions and then do favors for them. That's ridiculous. It was such an obvious dodge, and it was the sleaziest political trick ever. 9/11. There's a great Family Guy clip of Lois when she's running. 9/11. It was, but this is an example where it wasn't actually a trick. It's a legitimate response. Now, why is that? Because Ted Cruz brings up New York values in a demeaning, condescending, dismissive, smug way, as if to suggest, well, I mean, come on, you guys know the deal. Sure, people in California, people in New York, people in Massachusetts, they're Americans, fine, but they're not the real Americans. The real Americans are in the heartland of America. The real Americans are in the red states. So when I say that New York values are represented in Donald Trump, I don't mean it in a positive way. I mean that, let's keep it real here, those New Yorkers, they're not the best of America. They're not the best people. The best people are the far right wingers in Mississippi and in Nebraska and in Kentucky. And that is a fucked up thing to say. And what does Donald Trump do? He's like, oh, really? They're bad people? Who did a lot of the cleanup there on 9/11? You do know Americans came together and New Yorkers came together, and we got through a very difficult time, and those are New York values. New York values are looking out for your fellow man and understanding that we're one and the same. New York values are Well, Trump didn't go this far because he probably doesn't even believe it to this extent, but, you know, it's diversity, it's multiculturalism, it's befriending people from all different kinds of backgrounds and all coming together under the banner of being an American and a New Yorker and loving each other and working together. I've lived in New York my entire life, man. I love New Yorkers. I absolutely do. And I don't, you know, I don't think that an argument like Ted Cruz is making to smugly dismiss New Yorkers, I don't think it's accurate. I think it's an asshole thing to say. And I think Donald Trump, who's the king asshole here, really one-upped and kind of checkmated Ted Cruz when he says, oh, really? That's what you think of New Yorkers? Well, let me tell you what I think of New Yorkers. Let me tell you what I think of New Yorkers. They're great people. And, you know, perhaps you should hold back on this kind of criticism, just attacking those kinds of people for who they are. Now, Trump obviously does it about Mexicans and Muslims and everybody else. But he won that exchange, and he won that exchange big time. And I was tweeting about this at the time, and basically I said, Ted Cruz is saying, New York bad. And then Trump said 9/11, and Ted Cruz immediately pivoted to New York good. And he made the weird face and did the clap. That was ownage, man. Or as the internet says, that was ponage all day long. Okay. Now let's move on to Marco Rubio getting wacky here. Marco Rubio is going to get wacky here discussing foreign policy at the Republican debate. He gets a little overexcited, and he makes silly points.
Barack Obama does not believe that America is a great global power. Barack Obama believes that America is an arrogant global power that needs to be cut down to size. And that's how you get a foreign policy where we cut deals with our enemies like Iran, and we betray our allies like Israel, and we gut our military, and we go around the world like he has done on 10 separate occasions and apologize for America. He doesn't understand the threat in ISIS. He consistently underestimates it, but I do not. There is a war against ISIS, not just against ISIS, but against radical jihadist terrorists, and it is a war that either they win or we win. When I'm president of the United States, we are going to win this war on ISIS. The most powerful intelligence agency in the world is going to tell us where they are. The most powerful military in the world is going to destroy them. And if we capture any of them alive, they are getting a one-way ticket to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and we are going to find out everything they know.
Breathe, breathe, reel it in, plastic boy. Reel it back in. I can't stand Marco Rubio's fake politician cadence and rhythm. Everything is talking points. Everything is empty suit, prepackaged. Here's what you say. Here's how you say it. And let me tell you something about Barack Obama and his foreign policy and how weak it is. Do you like the way I'm pointing? I was taught to point like a politician like this. Woosah. Now, of course, the substance of what he's saying is absurd. I had trouble keeping up there with all of his ridiculous points. First of all, if you argue that Guantanamo Bay should still be open, don't you dare argue at other times, as Marco Rubio does, that the Constitution is not debatable. And we're going to cover that segment later. He talks about the Second Amendment, and he's like, it's not an option. It's not a suggestion. And he's very smug and like, hello, this is off the table. That's why it's the Constitution. But somehow Guantanamo Bay, that's on the table. That is not a violation of habeas corpus and due process in any way, shape, or form. That's not a violation of the Constitution and perhaps the Eighth Amendment, protection from cruel and unusual punishment. No way whatsoever an extrajudicial system, which is by definition unconstitutional. No, that's not unconstitutional. So just spare me, man. If you want to make this argument, fine, but then don't come to me later and say, I care so much about the Constitution. You don't. And another thing, he loves NSA spying, too. Funny how he says, Second Amendment, that counts. Don't argue against the Constitution. But violating the Fourth Amendment and protection from unreasonable search and seizure? That one doesn't count because I don't like that one. So just put that aside. Just contradicts himself nonstop. And also, let's face some facts here. If you argue, yes, I would like to keep Guantanamo open, he might not even realize it, but what he's arguing for effectively is the system that made it so that we tortured innocent people. That's what happened at Guantanamo. That's not in dispute.
We had the Senate torture report that came out. We learned that at least 20% of the people we tortured were totally innocent. And people died when we tortured them, and they were innocent. And by the way, there were hundreds of innocent people at Guantanamo Bay. How do I know that? Other reports had come out that the Bush administration cut a deal with the government of Pakistan and Afghanistan and said, you send us jihadists because we just got attacked here on 9/11, and we'll send you money and we'll send you support. So what happened? Well, naturally, who the fuck should trust the government of Pakistan and Afghanistan? What happened? They just shipped whoever they wanted to us, people who were anti-government protesters in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then we locked them up, and then we tortured them. They weren't guilty of anything, and they're just sending people our way so that they can get money and rewards, and they're not even the right people. And these are the people that we held extrajudicially. This is why it's a problem. This is why you can't have extrajudicial prisons. You have to prove that the person you're holding is a terrorist. You can't just assume it. Government doesn't always get it right about shit like this. Are you kidding me? So, you know, I dismiss him based off that alone. But then Obama's soft on ISIS. Right. He's dropped literally thousands of bombs on them. How the fuck is that soft? It's not. You just have verbal diarrhea in your attack against him. And you don't have a substantive attack against him. So you just like, nah, he's weak. And, of course, the nonsense about, this president has abandoned Israel. Really? He abandoned Israel, which is why he did the Iran nuke deal, which takes away any pathway they have to a nuke. And, oh, yeah, he gives them over $1 billion a year and said, I will up that aid, and also gave them Iron Dome, which knocks Hamas rockets right out of the air. Tell me again how he abandoned them. Unbelievable, the claims that these guys make. And he's mocking the Iran deal. Like, these guys are amazing, because they'll say in one sentence, we have to stop Iran from getting a nuke. And then in the next sentence, they're like, this deal's horrible. But the deal stops Iran from getting a nuke. So you're contradicting yourself. Do you want them to get a nuke or not? If you don't do this deal, they're much more likely to get a nuke. And then finally, to the point about, you know, Obama doesn't think America is a grand country. He thinks it's an arrogant country. Well, first of all, apparently not, because he's done interventions in 7 different countries, military interventions. We still have over 900 military bases all around the world. And when you look at our military spending, the chart of it, we spend more than the next 14 biggest nations combined. And most of them are our allies. So he does believe we're a grand nation that should rule the world. And he doesn't think we're arrogant. But allow me to respond to this and say, he should think it's arrogant. By what measure is that not arrogant? For us to have 900-plus military bases, spend more than the next 14 biggest militaries combined, spend trillions of dollars on unnecessary wars like in Iraq, be involved in 7 different countries, do strikes in 7 different countries, on what planet is that not arrogant? Only on planet Rubio, who's a puppet of the establishment and who's getting his strings pulled by people like Sheldon Adelson, who want him to say these ridiculous things and be super hawkish. Marco, the American people do not agree with you. Utter clown. How about you look at some polling data, you see what the American people want, and you actually try to represent them in a democracy? I know, a crazy idea. Okay, I got to take one more break here, and then when we come back, I got a lot to get to, and it's going to be fun. The last 30 minutes of the week is going to be really fun. We're going to get into guns, like I said, Rubio's ridiculous claims on the Second Amendment. And Christie gets very confused about Syria, and then I'll get to the undercard debate, and we got some doozies for that coverage. Stay right there, guys.
Son of a bitch. All right, we're back, guys. I got to hurry. I fucking refuse to not get in all the stories today. So, here we go. Marco Rubio discussed guns and the Second Amendment at the debate last night, and he said multiple false things.
To take people's guns away, yet under his presidency, gun sales have more than doubled. That doesn't sound like a White House unfriendly to gun owners.
That sounds like people afraid the president's going to take their guns away.
Of course.
Is not an option. It is not a suggestion. It is a constitutional right of every American to be able to protect themselves and their families. I am convinced that if this president could confiscate every gun in America, he would. I am convinced that this president, if he could get rid of the Second Amendment, he would. I am convinced because I see how he works with his attorney general, not to defend the Second Amendment, but to figure out ways to undermine it. I have seen him appoint people to our courts, not to defend the Second Amendment, but to figure out ways to undermine it. Here's my second problem. None of these instances that the president points to as the reason why he's doing these things would have been prevented. You know why? Because criminals don't buy their guns from a gun show. They don't buy their guns from a collector.
Muslims in the West have to remember that
this
they
is an Al-Qaeda
are
guy.
Placed to play an important and decisive part in the jihad against the Zionists and Crusaders, and to do major damage to the enemies of Islam, waging war on their religion, sacred places and things, and brethren. This is a golden opportunity. And a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the way to show one's appreciation and thanks for this blessing is to rush to discharge one's duty to his ummah and fight on its behalf with everything at his disposal. And in the West, you've got a lot at your disposal. Let's take America as an example. America is absolutely awash with easily obtainable firearms. You can go down to a gun show at the local convention center and come away with a fully automatic assault rifle without a background check and most likely without having to show an identification card. So what are you waiting for?
That would be an Al-Qaeda guy saying, take advantage of lax gun laws and no background checks in America. Multiple times last night, both in the undercard debate and the regular debate, people said stuff like, there is no gun show loophole. Al-Qaeda disagrees. In fact, that's unbelievably untrue. About 40% of gun purchases in the U.S. are done through the gun show loophole, where they don't need to have a background check or anything. And to get to more specifically here into what Rubio was saying, not only did he say the thing about, you know, hey, criminals and ISIS, they can't buy the guns without a background check. Not true. But look at everything else he said, too. He's convinced that Obama's coming to take your guns. Okay, well, let's just be clear about this. You made that up. There's no evidence for that. There's no data for that. You can't point to any actions of him actually doing that. Everything that he's done on guns is a matter of public record. The most extreme thing he did was rather moderate when he tried to ban assault weapons, not retroactively, but from here forward, okay, which means 300 million guns in America, all kinds of guns, would just be left alone, ban high-capacity magazines and do a universal background check. So what do you mean he's coming to take your guns? He told you what he's in favor of. He didn't get what he wanted, but he told you what he's in favor of, and it wasn't taking your guns. And to these new executive actions, they're not even executive orders. We need to be clear about that, too. They're executive actions, which are different because they're not legally binding like executive orders are. And what is it? It's just a way to try to get people who are skirting the background check system that the ATF set up. It's a way to try to force them to be part of that system so they have to do background checks. Because many people say, hey, I'm a private seller, but then they sell guns for a living, which means you're not a private seller and you're more of a dealer. And then what happens? Those are usually the people who end up selling guns that get on the black market and go to drug cartels and bad people. So there's a problem here, and he's just ignoring it completely. And, of course, the worst part, as we referenced earlier, is the Constitution's not debatable. This isn't an option. Yeah, that's true. The only problem is Do you apply this to the Fourth Amendment? Protection from unreasonable search and seizure? So NSA spying. No, he's in favor of NSA spying, so you don't care about the Fourth Amendment. How about due process? You don't care about that either. You're in favor of Guantanamo Bay. Don't tell me you love the Constitution. You don't love the Constitution. And furthermore, your interpretation of the Second Amendment isn't true. The words are a well-regulated militia. He argues we can't regulate guns. But wait, the word regulated is right in the amendment. What do you mean we can't regulate it? Well, I'm a constitutionalist. I'm an originalist. Oh, you're an originalist, are you? Well, tell me what guns existed back when the founders wrote that amendment. It was fucking muskets. It took an hour and a half to reload. So if you want to be literal about this, people in a militia have a right to a fucking musket. I thought you were an originalist. You don't like that interpretation? Well, then why are you you're an activist judge? Why do you have a living document interpretation? You got to be an originalist. What are you doing? No, these guys are unbelievable, man. He's wrong about everything he said there. And he's running further to the right. But believe you me, he still is the establishment fallback. Rubio's strategy is to run to the right to get enough support from the base, but then at other times he'll appear somewhat more sane and more moderate than everybody else on stage. It served him pretty well at this point, but obviously Trump still has that commanding lead. But he's hanging in there even though he says ridiculous things. Okay, next. Oh, God, now we got to go to Chris Christie and his confusion. Chris Christie is very confused about Syria and Assad and ISIS. So let's listen to his ramblings here on that topic and see if you can make sense of it, because he's going to, like, interchange Assad with ISIS at times, and he just seems to generally not know what the fuck he's talking about. Let's listen and then we'll discuss.
Governor Christie, how important is it to remove Assad from power, and how would you do it?
Marie, you look at what this president and his Secretary of State Clinton has done to get us in this spot. I mean, think about it. This is the president who said, along with his Secretary of State, drew a red line in Syria, said if Assad uses chemical weapons against these people, then we're going to attack. He used chemical weapons. He's killed now over 250,000 of his own people. And this president has done nothing. In fact, he's done worse than nothing. This president, and by the way, Secretary Clinton, who called Assad a reformer. She called Assad a reformer. Now, the fact is, what this president has done is invited Russia to play an even bigger role. Bring in Vladimir Putin to negotiate getting those chemical weapons back from Assad. Yet what do we have today? We have the Russians and the Iranians working together, not to fight ISIS, but to prop up Assad. You're not going to have peace in Syria with Assad in charge. You're simply not. And so Senator Graham is right about this. And if we want to try to rebuild the coalitions, as Governor Kasich was saying before, then what we better do is to get to the Arab countries that believe that ISIS is a threat not only to them but to us and to world peace and bring them together. And believe me, Assad is not worth it. Hillary Clinton cannot be president. It will lead to even greater war in this world. And remember this. After Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama has had nearly 8 years, we have fewer democracies in the world than we had when they started. That makes the world less peaceful, less safe. In my administration, we will help to make sure that we bring people together in the Middle East, and we will fight ISIS and defeat them.
Thank you, sir.
That was unbelievable. He's the most confused guy I've ever seen on this issue and on foreign policy in general. I believe it was the last debate we covered a similar story, and I was questioning, and I'm like, wait, does he – I don't think he knows what the fuck's going on in Syria. I don't think he gets it. I don't think he understands the Sunni-Shia divide. I don't think he understands the broader picture here. And this confirms it for me. So let's go through a bunch of what he says. He talks about Assad's chemical weapons and the red line, and then he's blaming Obama drew a red line, and then he did nothing. He did nothing. Except that's not true. What he did is he ended up getting the chemical weapons from Assad. So we got exactly what we wanted without having to fire a shot. They were talking about, oh my God, Assad, a humanitarian disaster. And let's be clear, there was evidence that both sides used chemical weapons. So to just focus on Assad means you're ignoring the rebels when they do the exact same thing. But they did something. They did the best thing possible. If the whole goal was we got to get rid of those chemical weapons, we did that without having to fire a shot. And that was through diplomacy with Russia, and John Kerry was involved in that.
So he didn't do anything. No, he did, and he got exactly what we wanted. So that's point number one. Then he goes on, well, Assad's killed 250,000 people. That's just not true. Now, people actually tweet this at me, and these are people who are 100% on the side of the rebels in a blind way to the point where they don't even acknowledge that a lot of the rebels are war criminals as well, and there are jihadists and Islamists on the rebel side. But 250,000 is like the total dead in Syria from the beginning of the civil war. When you go and look at the details of that, and you can go to any respected international human rights organization you want, the breakdown is basically 50-50 for casualties, meaning half the casualties are on the rebel side, half the casualties are on the government side. So this idea that, blame him, he killed 250,000 people. What are you talking about? You're blaming him for the deaths on both sides? Doesn't make any sense. That's not true. And then he goes to, well, Russia and Iran, I mean, they're not fighting ISIS. They're propping up Assad. Wait. Those are one and the same. To prop up Assad, you have to fight ISIS. Assad is fighting ISIS. ISIS are one of the biggest rebel groups in the region, along with al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. So that's the same thing. But he says it as if it's like he made his brilliant distinction. Like, yeah, they're just propping up Assad. They're not fighting ISIS. To prop up Assad, you have to fight ISIS. And then he goes on to say, well, we got to get Arab countries involved here to do their part. Yeah, but hold on. You do know that the Arab countries are funding some of the worst rebel elements. I mean, they're pumping in cash and money to groups that are openly Islamist and jihadist. So getting them involved, they're not going to, like, he has this idea that if the Arab countries get involved, that, oh, this is going to work out well. No, you're probably going to get a power vacuum and a worse government to take Assad's place where it's Islamist or jihadist. Is that what you want? I mean, what a joke. And then, hilariously, he says, Hillary would lead to more war. Everything you're saying is, let's do more war. And you're like, you know, Hillary, that would lead to more war if you elect her. What the fuck? Everything you're saying is more war. What do you mean? And then finally, after ranting against Assad the entire time, at the end he says, my administration would go after ISIS. Okay, now I know you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You don't know who's on what side and what's happening here. Because Assad is fighting ISIS. Assad is fighting ISIS. You don't have to like Assad to acknowledge that. That's a fucking fact. He's fighting Islamists and jihadists and the rebels, okay? So when you spend the entire time ranting against Assad, Assad's bad, Assad this, Assad that, and at the end you're like, and that's why we're going to fight ISIS. So you're going to team up with him. You're going to be de facto allies with him to fight ISIS in the end of it after you just said you want to fight him. It's either that or you literally want to fight by both sides in the war. That is, say it with me now, a quagmire. That's what that is. That's exactly what Bush did in Iraq when he got in the middle of the Sunni-Shia civil war. That's exactly what Chris Christie's calling for here in Syria. This is nothing but pure confusion. And I honestly don't think he's educated on the topic. I don't. I don't think he knows much about Sunni versus Shia. I don't think he knows much about what's happened in the region in the past decade or so. I don't think he gets it. I don't think he gets it. And I think that if you vote for a guy like this, you're going to vote for George W. Bush 2.0. And it's going to be a guy who's chasing his own tail and trying to learn on the job the most basic foreign policy facts that there are. All right, now we go to Fiorina. Fiorina was asked a question about guns at last night's undercard debate. And take note not only of what she says here, but also the crowd's reaction. This is incredible.
President has just issued an executive order to expand the gun laws and background checks. Now, none of you on stage agree with this, but recent polls show the majority of Americans are in favor of universal background checks.
Not in this room.
It's the poll data.
So and we all believe the poll data all the time, don't we?
So tell me. Why, in your view, is the president's proposal a problem?
Oh, it's a problem for so many reasons. First of all, it is yet another lawless executive order. You see, he doesn't like the fact that Congress has rejected his ideas twice on a bipartisan basis, so he's decided he just gets to override them. Sorry, Mr. President, not the way the Constitution works. Secondly...
Okay, where do I begin? First of all, she has no clue what she's talking about. These weren't executive orders. These were executive actions, which are actually different. Executive actions being not legally binding, executive orders being legally binding. Second of all, every constitutional group that has come out and spoke about his move here, they've said, no, it's perfectly constitutional. He's just giving guidelines to the ATF and saying, hey, here's what we should try to do more of. That's it. And his suggestion is, how about we have more people who sell guns register as gun dealers, as opposed to having people be private sellers and do no background checks for the people they sell guns to. It's only the most reasonable thing anybody has ever thought of. And Carly Fiorina is acting like it's unconstitutional. She's acting like he's overstepping his bounds here. And she's daring to pretend like, you know, the people are against that. You know, Congress overrode him, and he's got to follow the rules of the way this works. But wait, Congress are the ones not following the rules, because the overwhelming majority of the American people want universal background checks, and they rejected that. So if you should be mad at anybody not following the system the way it's supposed to go, be mad at Congress. Because if they were doing what their job was, they would say, okay, the people want this. This is a representative democracy. This isn't unconstitutional. So let me go ahead and vote for it. But no, they blocked it. And then also, oh my goodness, the beginning of that was adorable. And this is how you know this is the far right base in that room. The host, the moderator, just brings up a fact. Hey, the overwhelming majority of Americans want to do background checks. Hey, boo, boo, boo. What are you booing?
Boo, background checks. Let crazy people get guns and former felons and terrorists.
How can you boo that? How can you boo that? I looked up the number, by the way. A poll from about a year ago found that 92% of the American people want to do a universal background check. In the crowd, that's the 8%. The 8% is in the crowd. Boo, boo, boo. Well, now you know how extreme they are, and I like how Carly was such a failure of a politician with her response there. Like, I can get the room to like me if I agree with them on this, if they boo background checks. And she's like, we always believe the polls, don't we? Don't we? Carly, it was a scientific poll. Carly, what are you doing here? Let's relax, breathe. Are you serious? 92%. What's the plus or minus on that? 3%? Sorry, guys, it was only 89%. I guess they were wrong in saying that most Americans want universal background checks. This is ridiculous in every way, shape, and form. People in other countries watch, you know, debates like this and interactions like this, and they facepalm. Like, are these guys fucking serious? We have 33,000 gun deaths every single year. Homicides, suicides, accidents, you name it. Other modern nations have, like, 100 or less. Why is that? Because we have over 300 million guns in circulation, and we don't even have basic gun laws. I mean, 40% of gun sales have no background check through the gun show loophole. This is madness to not do anything. And Obama proposes 0.2% change. They're like, unconstitutional! Oh my God, this is unbelievable! No, what's unbelievable is you, when you casually discuss and the audience boos 92% of what the American people want, which is a common sense idea like background checks.
Okay.
I got more on Carly. Carly Fiorina was asked a question about foreign policy and ISIS, and I think she gave the worst answer possible. So let's listen, and then I'll explain why.
The world shares a common enemy right now in the way of ISIS. Russia, the European Union, Saudi Arabia, Iran, China. We all agree ISIS is a threat, and it must be stopped. During World War II, the world partner with Joseph Stalin, who was arguably one of the most formidable, despicable figures of the 20th century, but they partnered with him to fight the Nazis. Today, everyone seems to agree we need some kind of coalition to fight ISIS. Do you agree with that? And if so, would your coalition include possibly Russia and Iran?
We need to be very clear-eyed now about who are our allies and who are our adversaries. In the fight against ISIS, Saudi Arabia is our ally. Iran is our adversary. And despite Donald Trump's bromance with Vladimir Putin and Russia are our adversary. We cannot.
Yeah, when I heard this, I thought, oh, Carly Fiorina is an establishment idiot. She's an elitist clown. Why? Because this is how deep her thinking goes. Those are our friends. Saudi Arabia is our ally. They're our friend. Why, Carly? They're our friend because they're our friend. Because previous presidents and going decades back, we made deals with them. They're our friends as a result of that, so we stay with them. Well, that's just surface-level thinking. Because you have to accept the situation as it is today, right now. And what's happening right now? Well, Iran is a Shia nation. Russia has business interests, and they're aligned with Iran, the Shia nation, and Syria, Assad, who's a Shia alawite. And they are what we would call natural allies against ISIS. Now, why are they natural allies? Because ISIS, they're a radical Sunni organization. It's a Salafi jihadist organization. Salafi jihadism is an ideology that comes from Saudi Arabia. Their government is a Salafi government. I mean, they are an extreme conservative interpretation of Islam in Saudi Arabia. Their government is based on that. And they spread this ideology through the world. You know, they said, we're not going to take in any Syrian refugees, but we'll send them to Europe, and then we'll pay for Wahhabi mosques, Salafi mosques in Europe. So they're spreading the ideology of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They're exporting the ideology. And then they turn around to the U.S. as they have radical clerics preaching in their mosques, talking about how we're the infidel, we're evil, down with the big bad West. And then they turn us and they're like, oh no, we're totally on your side. No, we're with you 100%. If you're with us 100%, stop spreading your shitty ideology that preaches how we're the devil and we're evil and the West is horrible and the Shia are horrible. Stop doing it. But they're not going to stop doing it. Why? Because ideologically, they agree. They're Salafi jihadists. So she doesn't understand any of this. She thinks Saudi's our friend because they're our friend. Because I've heard that they're our friend, so they're our friend. Even though they're, as many people have pointed out, an ISIS that made it. They fucking kill people. They behead people for apostasy, for drug smuggling. They've said all atheists are terrorists. They have a gross human rights record. They do what ISIS does, and they're a state. Just because we have an oil deal with them, Fiorina's like, I don't care, I will never criticize them, and they're an ally against ISIS. Except they're not. They're not an ally against Salafi jihadism. They're just not. Whereas the government of Iran, which is bad, of course, they're a Shia Islamist government, but they are a natural ally against ISIS, and you got to defeat ISIS or you have to find a way to contain the threat. So why not line up with Russia? This is an opportunity to mend fences and become allies again with Russia and with Iran. And I'm not saying you turn on Saudi and you go fight a war against Saudi. No, you can be more neutral towards them and just untangle a little bit with them and, you know, find a way to work together to defeat ISIS with the natural allies being Iran and Russia. So, you know what it is? It's just she doesn't know anything. She's not educated on the topic, but she's super smug, and she has this condescending tone, and she's this blowhard, like, I will reaffirm these are our allies, and those are not our allies. And it's like, you're just giving the wrong answer. The problem is not going to be solved the way you want to solve it, because the same people who you think are our best friend are funding that ideology. It ain't gonna work. Mike Huckabee had some interesting comments in his closing statement last night in the undercard debate. Let's take a look.
There's got to be some leadership that not only addresses the monetary and military issues of this country, but the moral issues of this country. At the end of every political speech, most of us say, God bless America. But how can he do that when we continue to slaughter 4,000 babies a day? And I want to be the president that treats every person, including the unborn, as a person and protect them under the 5th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. I close with this word from a gentleman in East Texas named Mutel Luker. He's 100 years old, and I met him down in East Texas, and he said this to me. I sure wish, Mike, we had the days when the Ten Commandments were in all of our capitals and in every school, and we prayed again. You know, he may be 100 years old, but I believe some of those old ideas to get this country back where we unapologetically get on our knees before we get on our feet might be the best solutions we've ever sought as a country. And I ask for your support and your vote. Thank you.
Prayer and the Ten Commandments are, quote, the best solutions we've ever sought as a country. The best solutions. Mike, that ain't even a solution. Never mind the best solution. Prayer. Getting on your knees and wishing it were so is the best thing we could do. Sprinkle some goat blood in the corner of our house and do a little rain dance around the fire while we're at it. How about that? Why not speak in tongues? You know, why not use a Ouija board? Why not go to Dr. Seuss, Green Eggs and Ham, to look for some wisdom about this is the best solution for America? You're a child. You're a fucking child. The Ten Commandments. We need the Ten Commandments in every government and building and every state house, every court. That's not, first of all, that's not going to do anything, okay? Second of all, the Ten Commandments are nowhere near the 10 best rules to keep society in order. What is it, only like two of them or three of them are laws? Most of them are like, you know, don't fuck your neighbor's wife. You probably shouldn't do that, but should it be a law? No. What if she's hot and she's into you and their marriage is fucked up and they're going to leave? Anyway, I digress from that. Even a little too much into my own mindset here. Don't build statues to other gods. That's one of the commandments. You left off child rape from the list, but you put that on the list. Not the best list. You know, you can honestly get together in a room full of fifth graders. They'll come up with a better list than the shit in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments and prayer is the best solution for this country. The best. No, it's not. And I always find it hilarious that these are the same people, and these are the first people to do false cries about Sharia law is coming to Oklahoma. No, it's not, but you'd probably like it if it did. Because the thing is, they're okay with religious voodoo nonsense being shoved down your throat as long as it's their religious voodoo nonsense. If it's the other, if it's, you know, Muslims or Hindus or whatever, well then, oh my God, this is unbelievable. How can we have a system like this? No, I agree. But I also don't want your shitty ideology shoved down my throat when it's not true and it's ridiculous. How can you be an adult? Like, I get it. There are plenty of religious people who are great people. And they're secular, so they get it. My religion is my religion. That's my business. I'm not going to force it on you in the government. But how can any adult actually believe that? Like, no, that is the way to go. Let me take my made-up shit, which is just an opinion, which is my faith, and I'm going to force it on you. I've never heard of anything more arrogant in my life. It's as arrogant as it gets. And then, of course, I have to mention the slaughter of 4,000 babies, except that's not true. I mean, he says these things like, yeah, that's right, Mike. We all get together, a literal baby that was just born. We're like, okay, here's the knife. No, he's talking about abortion, of course. And late-term abortion is illegal in the U.S. It's illegal. So all this is gametes and zygotes and embryos and pre-gestation fetuses. No nervous system developed. No pain whatsoever. It's 100% the woman's choice. This isn't a moral conundrum here. Every modern nation does this. Every modern nation has this. It's not murder.
There's a reason we don't call it murder. It ain't fucking murder. I get it. Late term's a different story. I'm even against late term in some cases. There are exceptions, life of the mother, fatal fetal defect, infanticide, stuff like that. But this isn't that. This isn't late term. So it's just made up. It's incorrect. But why would we expect anything different? It's Mike Huckabee. Okay. I'm out of time, guys. I have two more that I wanted to get to. I'm going to save them for Monday. I'm going to come back to them on Monday because they're just that good. But it was fun. Love you guys. Everybody have a great weekend. I'm fucking hungry. I'm going to go eat a lot. All right, everybody. Later. Peace.